The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Derek Frost from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Triangle Business Journal. And we start on the front page of the Triangle Business Journal with the cover story headline, MBA Migration. Business graduates flock to tech sector as financial services industry looks for ways to retain smartest students. That was the front page headline. The article begins inside the Triangle Business Journal with a separate headline, From Banks to Tech, MBA Grads Shift Preference. And this is written by Harrison Miller. When Brad Nieske first started to study business at UNC Chapel Hill, he wanted to learn about investing and venture capital. He also wanted to learn about corporate strategy and acquisition opportunities. Nieske, who grew up in Winston-Salem, dove into the financial world after graduation, working at Wells Fargo and then Frontier Capital, as he learned the nuances of mergers and acquisitions. But 5 years after turning his Carolina blue tassel, Nieske decided to don a darker shade and earn an MBA from Duke University's Fuqua School of Business. Nieske, now 29 and in his second year of the program, hasn't headed for Wall Street, at least not yet. Instead, he is interning at LinkedIn in San Francisco, working in corporate development. There, he is putting his past M&A experiences into practice while learning about operational strategy. Nieske is part of a growing trend as many MBA students are exploring tech opportunities instead of financial services. Nationally, a rising number of MBA graduates are picking tech jobs over the world of banking and finance. As tech gets larger, they have a better ability to acquire high-level talent, Nieske says. There's similar pay and lots of perks, and millennials enjoy more of a lifestyle balance. However, I think that's being combated at banks that are raising salaries and paying employees more. The share of full-time MBA graduates from the top 10 business schools accepting jobs at financial services firms dropped from 36% to 26% between 2012 and 2017, according to data from U.S. News and World Report. Meanwhile, the shares of graduates accepting jobs in technology rose from 13% to 20% during the same time frame. This is a major shift from a decade ago when top MBA graduates flocked to finance. By 2016, consulting jobs outpaced finance's popularity, according to the Graduate Management Admission Council, or GMAC, which administers the GMAT, the test used for admission into graduate management programs. Now, another shift is underway, and that has implications for tech-heavy companies in the Triangle looking to lure and retain the best young talent. The shifting perspectives comes at a challenging time for many MBA programs, with students keenly weighing the value of the degree and its impact on their careers. The GMAC reported last September that national applications to full-time MBA programs has dropped for 3 straight years. Wake Forest University, citing declining interest, closed its full-time program in 2015, and other schools, including Virginia Tech, have done the same. Those students plunging ahead with a full-time program want a return on their investment, both in salary and quality of life, and many are turning to the less buttoned-down but still profitable world of tech. Tech is a major player in the world of MBA employment, says Cheryl Dirks, Associate Dean of Recruiting and Operations at Duke's Fuqua School of Business. 10 years ago, that wasn't the case. Numbers rise for interest in tech. According to a 2016 Universum Global report, based on a survey of 72,000 students, universities, and employee evaluations, tech firms made up half of the top 10 most desired places to work for MBA graduates. Topping the list was Google, with Amazon number 6, Facebook 7, Microsoft 8, and Apple 9, all making the list. Consulting firms took up spots 2 through 5, and Goldman Sachs was the only bank to make the list, placing it at the number 10 most desired place to work. The Triangle doesn't have a significant presence from Apple or Amazon, at least not yet, but it does have a rising tide of tech companies looking for bright minds. The appeal of technology jobs indicates the growing role technology plays in everyday lives and its appeal to millennials. The surge has rippled across the Triangle's MBA schools as well. At Fuqua, roughly 500 students are part of the tech club between both years of the program, making up half the MBA class, according to Dirks. That number has increased in recent years. Similarly, at UNC Chapel Hill's Kenan Flagler Business School, around 200 students are members of the tech club, or roughly one-third of the total population, and has been increasing. Clubs are offering tech skills, coding, and computer languages. We're seeing a lot of student-to-student teaching, Dirk says. They demonstrate a willingness to learn and that they want a job. The number of local MBA students looking to build a career in tech is inching upward. At UNC, only 14% of MBA graduates went to jobs at tech firms in 2014, a number that rose to 19% in 2017. At NC State University, a higher percentage of students from the Jenkins MBA program have gravitated toward careers at tech firms, which makes sense given the Wolfpack's strong technology and engineering programs. During the 2013-14 academic year, 20% of graduates went into the technology industry. That number jumped to 33% in 2015, but settled back down to 23% in 2017. Overall, the tech industry has been the top destination of Jenkins School graduates overall since 2013. At Duke, the number of MBA students choosing jobs at technology companies has hovered around 20% of the graduates since 2014. The move toward tech employment does not mean MBA graduates are completely ditching the financial services industry. At UNC, 24% of graduates went into financial services in 2014. And 19% in 2017, same as the number of students accepting positions in technology enterprises. At Duke, 17% of graduates went into financial services in 2014 and 20% in 2017. At NC State, only 3% of the students joined financial service firms after graduating in 2014. In 2017, 23% of graduates went into the financial services industry, the highest percentage out of all available data dating back to 2006. But the financial sector is learning the recruiting game is changing. Banks still hire people, but they have to up their game, says Fuqua Dean Bill Boulding. If you're going to attract the current generation of students, you have to give them something that has meaning and purpose, not just the opportunity to make lots of money. Look to make a difference. The tech industry often appeals to a student's desire to make a difference at work and beyond. One of the biggest draws to tech is the industry fits the social profile of students, says Tanya Richardson, who leads global campus and corporate hiring at open source giant Red Hat in Raleigh. They expect and look for ways to make an impact. They want to work for a company that they believe is making a difference. With their investment in education, they expect to cash in. Not necessarily in a monetary sort of way, Richardson adds, but in an industry that's continuing to grow and evolve, marrying their social profile with expectations for a job. But the financial services industry is trying to level the playing field for the top MBA graduates with something the industry knows well, money. At Kenan Flagler, for example, the median salary for MBA graduates in the tech field has increased from $110,000 to $115,000 in the past 3 years. Meanwhile, financial services have increased their median salary by 20% during that period, with grads receiving a salary of $120,000 in 2017, up from the $100,000 median in 2014. At Duke, the median technology salary rose to $121,000 in 2017, up from $112,500 in 2014. For their peers in finance, the median salary rose to $125,000 in 2017, up from the $100,000 median in 2014. Despite increased MBA interest in tech and vice versa, there's less recruiting competition than you would think. There's always competition, says Red Hat's Richardson, but we end up recruiting ones that always had a foot in the tech space, ones that have a desire or have a curiosity about the space. A big part of it depends on the position you're hoping to go into, says Niesky. Those that are the more finance-oriented tend to go to banks, but those that want a managerial role seem to consider perks and lifestyle more important than when choosing a career. Both industries focus on high touch points and face time with students on campus. They work to create a personalized experience to get to know each potential employee. However, tech companies tend to use technology more as part of their process, incorporating video interviews and other mediums into their process. Tech recruiters tend to fill their positions later and are a bit more flexible with their hiring practices, according to Leslie McDowell, Senior Associate Director of Employer Engagement and Recruiting at Kenan Flagler's MBA program. Financial services requires a defined curriculum and have a specific number of open positions predetermined. If you decide in January you want to go into investment banking, it's already too late, says McDowell. They filled those jobs. Big tech companies make impact. There also appears to be more opportunity in the tech industry, according to the GMAC 2018 Corporate Recruiters Survey. Companies hiring MBA graduates was highest among the healthcare, tech, and energy utilities industry. Not only that, but over the past 4 years, tech companies have increased their MBA hires, while financial firms have decreased their numbers. Overall, 84% of tech firms hired an MBA student in 2017, up from 73% in 2013. Meanwhile, only 71% of financial service companies hired an MBA graduate last year, down from 76% in 2013, according to GMAC. Across the triangle, MBA students have rushed to these opportunities. At Duke's Fuqua School, tech companies made up 4 of the top 10 employers of MBA grads, with Amazon as the top recruiter, and Microsoft number 4, Apple number 9, and Google 10, all among the list. Bank of America was the only bank to make the top 10 at number 7, while consulting firms were the other top recruiters. Kenan Flagler reported similar rankings. In 2017, Amazon, Dell, and Cisco were all among the top 10 destinations for MBA graduates. And at NC State's Jenkins program, Cisco, Red Hat, Dell, and Sabre were some of the top recruiters for graduates. Understanding ways businesses operate, business acumen, data and analytics, business strategy, that knowledge and mentality is very beneficial, says Red Hat's Richardson. The tech industry is changing, and you need to have the ability to adapt to that change. MBA students can offer those different perspectives. Red Hat has a large MBA presence on its campus. The open-source software company has 200 interns, with an increase in upper-level graduates and MBA students, Richardson says. The tech companies are looking for what our curriculum offers, says McDowell. We offer a lot of analytics, sales, and managerial decision courses. Most of our students are self-starters. They're confident in their decision-making and have strong collaboration skills. The tech industry is broad, with product management, marketing, operations, and finance roles all needing to be filled. MBA students, even if they don't have much tech experience, have the skills to fill those roles. Collaboration and decision-making skills are also vital, in which companies want their employees confident. Students are seeing the tech industry as an attractive career opportunity because of growth, career diversity, and matching their own social goals. There's been a hiring surge because the tech industry has grown so much, Dirk says. Students see an opportunity, now and in the future. And now we turn to Biz, a quick glance at Triangle Happenings, written by Managing Editor Dane Huffman. You'll be tickled pink about staying at this home in Cary. Here's an interesting way to celebrate a house. A Cary landmark is inviting people to share their memories of a home that dates all the way back to the 1830s, when Andrew Jackson roamed the White House. The Guess White Ogle House on Academy Street, also known as the Pink House, will become the subject of a book, and the community is welcome to contribute. The home in the heart of Cary has been the scene of fundraisers, house walks, weddings, and other activities. The contest begins September 10 and runs through November 16. Send entries to pinkhouse@ogleentertainment.com. First and second place winners receive a cocktail reception and dinner at the Victorian home. First place also gets to spend the night. Owner Sheila Ogle is collaborating with Mary Innsbrucker on the project about the house, a designated historic landmark. The main focus of the book will have readers traveling through good and bad times as told through the eyes of the house, Innsbrucker says. Arts gets a boost with a taste of India. With more than 1,500 people in attendance, Raleigh's Memorial Hall was transformed into a Bollywood festival July 13 as popular Bollywood singer Shan entertained the audience to raise money for North Carolina Arts in Action. The event, the brainchild of Triangle businessman Arvind Mahajan, drew scores of local doctors, scientists, and financial managers, including UNC Rex's Ravi Shankar, Shah Capital's Himanshu Shah, Raleigh real estate investment firm Greenhawk Corporation's Sejan Agarwal, and Kerry Cardiology's Dr. P.M. Shah, among others. Mahajan says he hopes to engage the Indian American community more in the future to support North Carolina nonprofits by bringing a piece of Bollywood to the Triangle. The needs of this community are many, and I'm trying to connect the influential and successful Indian community to causes important to the broader Triangle through entertainment, he says. Why you shouldn't get irked about layers of security. Here at Biz, we get annoyed when our work email makes us fumble through the two-step authentication process while trying to do something important, such as, you know, make Labor Day plans. But a new survey demonstrates why companies are taking stronger measures. The recent CFO Global Business Outlook survey from Duke University found that 20% of global CFOs know their company has been hacked. Cam Harvey, the founding director of the study and a professor at Duke, says that number doesn't include companies that have been hacked and don't know it. 10 years ago, cybersecurity was not a C-suite responsibility, Harvey says. Now it is. Companies are defending themselves from near-continuous denial-of-service attacks and critical data breaches. To fight this battle costs money, which falls right off the bottom line. The cost is not just equipment, software, and consultants. It's also reputation if you're breached. Kannapolis makes a comeback. Kannapolis is best known as the home of the late Dale Earnhardt and a faded textile industry. But the town is showing some life and has a plan to invest $500 million in downtown, including a new ballpark, hundreds of apartments, a performing arts center, and more. Kannapolis City Manager Mike Legg says, "It's the old adage of throwing a rock in the pond and the ripples begin to expand outward." Amazon is planning a distribution center that will bring 600 jobs. Wayne Brothers Company has spent $7 million on its 450-employee campus. Mayor Daryl Hinnant says the tax base has risen from $2.4 billion in 2007 to $4 billion. New leader of USOC has deep ties to the Triangle. A Duke University graduate with strong ties to the Triangle is taking on a new role, CEO of the U.S. Olympic Committee. Sarah Hirschland, who graduated from Duke in 1997, has no Olympic experience and will take over a USOC rocked by the Larry Nassar scandal. She called the opportunity a dream come true, but added, "I also recognize the challenges ahead as we navigate this critical moment in the USOC's history." Early in her career, Hirschland worked at Total Sports, an online venture based in Raleigh that focused on sports data and was, frankly, far ahead of its time, as the Internet wasn't as widely used at that point. She then was one of the first employees at OnSport, a marketing firm that was acquired by Wasserman in 2002. Hirschland had served as chief commercial officer of the U.S. Golf Association before landing the USOC role. She lived in New Jersey with her husband and three children while with the USGA. DPAC has record year with a whopping 130 sellouts. With Jerry Seinfeld, the Phantom of the Opera, and Les Mis in the house, you'd expect the Durham Performing Arts Center to perform pretty well, but last season was huge, even by its standards. DPAC had a record 130 sellouts in the 2017-2018 season and reeled in 490,000 guests. Overall, the venue had 219 events for the year that ended June 30. The Phantom of the Opera was the top Broadway show, with Bon Iver the top concert and Seinfeld the top comedian. DPAC opened in 2008 and has 2,700 seats. Another big year is ahead, with Hamilton scheduled to run November 6 through December 2. And now we turn to the entrepreneurship page with Lauren Onisorge. The first headline, Get Spiffy adds another $9 million in funding. A year after Get Spiffy $7.5 million funder, the Research Triangle Park-based on-demand car services app has more than doubled its coffers, securing $9 million in new capital, according to the company. CEO and co-founder Scott Wingo says the latest funder, announced July 17, will fuel the company's growth trajectory. "We're growing across like five dimensions and we need capital to do it," he says. "We have a lot going on and need to continue to add fuel." Spiffy has about 125 employees, including more than 100 technicians, and its fleet is growing 400%, Wingo says, while more geographic expansion is anticipated. "For now, we're trying to get a handle on our fleet." All existing investors, including Durham's Bull City Venture Partners and Idea Fund Partners, participated in the round, as did new backers such as German filter manufacturer Mann and Hummel, Visionary Private Equity Group, the North Carolina Venture Capital Multiplier Fund, the Wolfpack Investor Network, and Venture South. AgTech Accelerator launches third startup. Research Triangle Park's AgTech Accelerator is launching its third startup, Vindara. According to a securities filing disclosed July 16, the stealthy firm has raised $2.3 million from 11 equity investors, sizably less than the other two firms in the accelerator's portfolio, Borogen and Skyline Vet Pharma, which penned raises of $10 million and $5 million, respectively, last year. John Dombrowski, AgTech Accelerator CEO, and listed as a Vindara executive in the filing, says the company is in its early stages, starting up from scratch in Alexandria Real Estate Equity's new plant science laboratories in RTP. "We're still trying to figure out what kind of varietals we're going to use," he says. But the plan is to center the new company around indoor farming genetics, figuring out ways to manipulate artificial light environments to create consumer-driven varietals. "You know how indoor farming is absolutely blowing up," he says. "One of the things that is an empty space in that area that we have recognized is being able to provide modern genetics and breeding toward indoor farming. So specifically, thinking about modern produce crops and thinking about it in a way that we would take genetics off of the shelf and have a specific breeding program focused toward the indoor farming areas of the world." Megan Lyman, the firm's counsel, says the funding comes from the syndicate the accelerator already has in place, which includes companies such as Bayer and Syngenta. With $65 million funder, RTP startup ready to expand. Armed with a new $65 million Series C funder, Research Triangle Park-born AgBiome is ready to scale. That's according to Dan Tomso, chief scientific officer, speaking hours after the firm announced the raise July 17. He says the cash, which follows a $35 million funder in 2015, will help keep our foot on the gas, and that means more innovation in its RTP laboratories. "We have a very ambitious goal here, to really be the most successful agricultural innovator," Tomso explains. "We've had our research pipelines running now for 5 years. We have leads in all kinds of different areas." In AgBiome's greenhouse laboratories, scientists analyze soil samples from across the globe to come up with those leads. They're seeking out tiny organisms known as microbes, which are often armed with genetic traits that protect plants from diseases or pests. AgBiome isolates those traits, then figures out how they can be used to protect crops in real products. The raise was fueled by 17 investors, according to a securities filing. Christina Burrow, managing director at Arch, says the caliber of talent at AgBiome, coupled with the market potential, led her firm, which first funneled money into the company nearly 5 years ago, to invest again. "We feel that the agriculture space is one that has potential for enormous growth," she says. AgBiome's platform of innovations was just incredibly exciting. Durham has huge quarter in venture capital funding. Companies in the Triangle dominated the state's venture capital investments in the second quarter, according to a new data from PricewaterhouseCoopers and CB Insights. All but one of the top 10 deals were Triangle companies, according to the report, and the bulk were in Durham. Here's that list. Bree Biosciences Durham, $280 million. Precision Biosciences Durham, $110 million. Stride Bio Durham, $15.7 million. Emergo Therapeutics, Durham, $12 million. Valencell, Raleigh, $10.5 million. Rain, Chapel Hill, $7.3 million. First, Durham, $5 million. Somnoware, Charlotte, $3.5 million. Hexa Tech, Morrisville, $2.7 million. And FlexGen Power Systems, Durham, $990,000. Silicon Valley startup expands to Raleigh. A San Francisco startup with more than $50 million in venture capital backing has picked Raleigh for its East Coast hub. Sysdig, a container monitoring firm whose major customers include French bank Societe Generale, has yet to sign the lease but is planning to open an office in Raleigh, a space with room for 30 people. It's a number Apurva Darve, chief marketing officer, says the firm hopes to soon eclipse. We'll grow faster than that, he says. And those new hires will include a site lead, likely recruited from the existing Triangle Tech scene, he says. It's a scene that includes two longtime partners of Sysdig's, Red Hat and IBM. We're going to grow an entire set of company operations in Raleigh, he says. Our goal is to have the first dozen employees off into the races within weeks. And finally, in a section called They Said It, here's what investors had to say about why they invested in Get Spiffy, the first article we told you about. Scott Wingo is one of the best entrepreneurs we've ever met. Proven guy. Proven business model, says Jason Kaplan, co-founder of Bull City Venture Partners. And Spiffy continues to grow much faster than we anticipated, he says. They are a services company, and they are growing like they're not a services company. Services companies tend to grow a little slower, but they're growing really fast, and we're excited about it where it's at, says Lister Delgado, managing partner of Idea Fund Partners. And finally, what Spiffy is doing in terms of changing, first the car wash business, and secondary, the oil change and servicing of the vehicle, it's very interesting to us because we are a very big player in the aftermarket, says Charles Valiant, Chief Technology Officer of Mann and Hummel. And now we turn to Jennifer Henderson's page on legal, life sciences, and education. Collaboration aims to save on costs in North Carolina's Medicaid reform. A collaboration of 11 North Carolina health systems is aiming for a piece of Medicaid reform in the state and a say in how the reform evolves. Reform of North Carolina's $14 billion Medicaid program involves moving from a fee-for-service model to a managed care model that will see the state's Department of Health and Human Services delegate management of services to prepaid health plans. It is scheduled to take effect July 1. It's a massive change that involves billions of dollars and millions of patients and 11 North Carolina health systems working with a New Mexico partner in an effort called North Carolina Provider-Owned Plans, or NCPOP, are competing with Blue Cross and Blue Shield of North Carolina, Aetna, and others for the work. Dating back about 5 years, the NCPOP health systems began seeking out expertise ahead of Medicaid change. They found that expertise in Presbyterian Healthcare Services, which has operated a provider-owned and led health plan in New Mexico for decades. We're able to leverage some of their technologies and processes that they have in place where we can get scale and efficiency at day one, says Lisa Farrell, president of NCPOP and the former head of the $2 billion Presbyterian Health Plan. Financial savings from partnering with Presbyterian are expected to be 2-3% of what NCPOP's premiums would be, according to Farrell. They had marched in the path we were trying to march, says Bart Pfizer, vice president of Revenue Cycle and Managed Care with Cape Fear Valley Health System, speaking of Presbyterian. Dr. Devduta Sangva, associate chief medical officer for Duke University Health System and Physician Leadership Council, co-chair at NCPOP, says the provider-owned plan will allow for better clinical outcomes and greater predictability on cost. He adds that by working together, we avoid the question of who's responsible for what. These healthcare delivery systems all agreeing to come together and take responsibility for health in a broader way is something that hasn't been done before, says Dr. Michael Steiner, associate professor of pediatrics and chief of the Division of General Pediatrics and Adolescent Medicine at UNC Chapel Hill. Locus, fueled by capital, adds California investor. Ties to Chinese technology giant Tencent and venture capital firms Artis Ventures of San Francisco are propelling Locus Biosciences to a new level. Locus, based in Research Triangle Park, caught the attention of Tencent and Artis last year, that is, when it came to substantial investments from both companies. Last summer, Locus secured a $5 million convertible note with Tencent Holdings leading the financing round that also included the NC Biotechnology Center. And later in the year, Tencent also participated in Locus's $19 million Series A round led by Artis. Paul Garofalo, co-founder, chairman, and CEO of Locus, says the technology and platform Locus is developing allows an enzyme to destroy dangerous pathogens, including bacteria resistant to multiple drugs, while leaving the good bacteria intact. Now, those financings, along with big-name lead investors on both, are allowing new growth and steps forward for Locus, including the acquisition of EpiBiome, a California-based competitor. The Series A round itself creates a valuation for the company that enables you to get lift like this, Garofalo said of Locus's deal for EpiBiome. New York law firm opens Raleigh office as part of expansion. A New York-based 370-lawyer firm has opened an office in downtown Raleigh, but Goldberg Sagala's founder and managing partner Rick Cohen says that roots in Raleigh are part of an even bigger plan for continued growth in North Carolina. We have 22 offices in 10 states, Cohen says. Goldberg Sagala's new Raleigh office is currently home to partners Leanne Gerlach, Ben Greenberg, and Gregory Horner, who all joined from Teague, Campbell, Dennis, and Gorham back in 2016, and three associates. The folks who came over from Teague, Campbell focus in workers' compensation defense of employers, and we have a group of clients who wanted us to expand that practice into North Carolina, says Cohen. The expansion of that practice started with a Greensboro office and quickly moved to the recruitment of a group of partners with related expertise in Raleigh, he says. The office is at 333 Fayetteville Street. UNC Spellings among national leaders in pay. North Carolina has some high earners when it comes to leaders of public universities and colleges, according to the Chronicle of Higher Education's annual survey of public college executive compensation. A dozen presidents across the U.S. banked $1 million or more in the most recent fiscal year. That's compared to eight in fiscal year 2016. For the study, the Chronicle looked at top leaders' salaries of public schools from 2010 through 2017 and private institutions from 2008 to 2015. Margaret Spellings, the president of the University of North Carolina system, ranked just outside the top 10 nationally at number 13 and first in North Carolina with total compensation of $977,077. That includes base pay of $775,000, bonus pay of $45,000, and other pay. Chancellor Randy Woodson of NC State University took in $826,136, including base pay of $617,376, and bonus pay of $203,086. Chancellor Carol Folt of UNC Chapel Hill had a total compensation topping $605,000. On average, public college executive compensation was up 5% in fiscal year 2017 to an average approaching $560,000. Among private schools, the Chronicle reported, President Nathan Hatch of Wake Forest University earned about $4 million. G1 hires experienced leader for cancer drug launch. G1 Therapeutics' latest C-suite hire is no stranger to commercializing blockbuster cancer treatment and is aiming to repeat that success at the Research Triangle Park-based company. John DeMari has joined G1 as its first chief commercial officer. He hails from Astellas Pharma, where he served as vice president of oncology marketing, including for the company's successful launch of multi-billion-dollar prostate cancer drug Xtandi. I knew they would be looking for a commercial leader at some point in the near future, says Damari of G1. He wants to replicate the success he oversaw at Astellas and build a top-notch commercial organization here. And now we turn to On Real Estate, written by Ben Graham. Quietly, RCC undergoes leadership change. A leadership shuffle at the highest rung of the Raleigh Convention Center has led to the removal of a longtime employee who oversaw the 500,000-square-foot facility since 2016. Former director Doug Grissom has been removed from his post by the city following an extended stint on administrative leave. The city has created a new job for Grissom, overseeing concert venues, which comes with a $13,000 pay cut. In his place, former deputy Wake County manager Joe Durham has filled the role of interim director. Durham retired from county government in 2014 after 13 years at his post. City officials aren't providing information on the reason for the leadership change, saying it's a personnel matter. Mayor Nancy McFarland says she hasn't seen any problems with the management of the convention center and directed questions about the change to city manager Ruffin Hall. Grissom could not be reached. Grissom began working at the convention center in 1988 and became director in the summer of 2016. He was put on administrative leave from early March to early June of this year, according to city officials. In his new role, Grissom will oversee the Coastal Credit Union Music Park at Walnut Creek and Red Hat Amphitheater and report to Durham. Grissom's pay has been reduced from $129,852 to $116,867. The new position allows the city to put more resources into managing the two arenas, Raleigh spokesman John Boyette said in an email. Durham, earning $90 per hour, has no plans to stay in the position long term. Denny Edwards, CEO of the Greater Raleigh Convention and Visitors Bureau, lauded the choice of Durham to fill the interim role because of his experience. He has a great understanding of our hospitality industry and knows who the players are, Edwards says. Edwards says officials should look for someone who has a grasp of broader trends in the convention center industry. Centennial Campus misses final mark for Army Command Center. The Triangle may have lost out on the sweepstakes for the U.S. Army's new Futures Command Center, but the North Carolina officials who worked on the failed bid don't view it as a total loss. Stuart Ruffin, executive director of the North Carolina Military Foundation, sees the Triangle's contention for the 500-job center as validation of the infrastructure already in place for companies and research institutions to partner with the Department of Defense. The fact that we made the top five says a ton about the innovation ecosystem here, he says. Ruffin helped coordinate dozens of academic and research institutions and government agencies in the pitch for the command center, which ultimately went to Austin, Texas. Among the traits Army officials sought was a metro area that had companies and institutions interested in partnering with the Department of Defense on research and innovation. On that front, Ruffin believes the Triangle ranked high. He cited programs such as the University of North Carolina Partnership for National Security and the National Security Agency's lab at Centennial Campus. That's a level of academic involvement that you truly won't see in other parts of the country, Ruffin says. The Triangle was one of five finalist metro areas, in addition to Boston, Minneapolis, and Philadelphia. Army Undersecretary Ryan McCarthy and Lieutenant General Eric Wesley visited the Triangle June 20 as part of the final round of site visits. On the trip, they toured three sites, Parmer RTP and the Frontier Campus and Research Triangle Park, and NC State University's Centennial Campus, with the latter drawing the most interest. Median price for Triangle homes up 7% in a year. Home sale trends continue to deepen throughout the Triangle at the halfway point of the year, with median prices rising 7% over last year. The median home price now tops out at $265,000, up from $248,000 at this time in 2017, according to data tracked by Triangle Multiple Listing Services. The only thing that's going on a straight upward path now is pricing, says Stacy Anfinson, appraiser with Birch Appraisal Group and author of the Triangle's Area Residential Realty Report. The price increases come as the home market remains tight across the region. The number of new listings has risen, but just 1.8% over this time last year. Anfinsen's analysis of only the second quarter found an increase in new listings as well, but the uptick was mostly due to new homes and not the needed resale inventory priced under $400,000, according to his TARR report. Demand for the limited inventory remained strong, with the average number of days a home sat on the market in the Triangle dropping from 37 through June of last year to 31 this year. Home prices continue to rise across the country. The trend is being driven by increased demand, fewer homes for sale, and higher labor and materials costs. Nowhere in the Triangle are the price increases as steep as Durham County, where the median sales price has jumped more than 11% over last year, rising from $228,000 to $253,000. Downtown landowner buys more in warehouse district. A Raleigh property owner has closed on another downtown parcel, pushing the company's total land holdings on a single block to nearly 1.5 acres. Empire Properties, founded by Greg Haddam, paid $1.85 million for a row of one- and two-story shop fronts at the corner of West Cabarrus and South Dawson Streets. The buildings are on the same block as two parcels the company is looking to develop at the corner of South Dawson and West Davie Streets. Empire Properties applied for a rezoning request last year that allows up to 12 stories on the land. The other property is between those lots and the building recently purchased by Empire Properties. Current zoning allows up to 4 stories. The buildings date to the 1940s and have belonged to Bryant and Sandra Garner and their family since 1950. Huge development gaining steam near Fuquay-Varina Arena. All of the new residential development sprouting around Fuquay-Varina Arena has reached its tendrils further south, outside of Wake County. Raleigh developer Greenfield Community has plans for a project that could result in more than 1,000 homes just over the Harnett County line. Greenfield President Matt Brubaker says the 447-acre community, dubbed Serenity Point, will provide a mix of housing types and prices to an area of northern Harnett County that hasn't seen large-scale residential development, all with a Fuquay-Varina address and within a 35-minute drive of downtown Raleigh. "We feel the market is ripe for it," Brubaker says. Land prices in Harnett County are cheaper. Home prices that can be sold for less than $300,000 are in high demand as in the Triangle, but are getting difficult to build as the costs of materials and labor rise. Now we have a page on Chapel Hill, written by Harrison Miller. Topper's Pizza to close Chapel Hill restaurant on Franklin Street. Topper's Pizza, the specialty late-night pizza chain, is closing its Franklin Street location at the beginning of August. The chain has served UNC Chapel Hill students and local residents for more than 4 years, opening in January 2014 at 306 West Franklin Street. Competition between pizza joints is stiff in downtown Chapel Hill. Franklin Street has 8 pizza-specific restaurants alone, with 2 more set to open later this year. This doesn't include the Italian or American-style eateries that also offer pizza as part of their menus. Chapel Hill has experienced quite a bit of business turnover in the past year. Spanky's, R&R Grill, Carolina Ale House, Artisan Pizza Kitchen, Sandwich, Vespa, Ristorante, and McAllister's Deli have all closed in recent years. Topper's Pizza's corporate office said, "We have been proud to serve our loyal fans in Chapel Hill. However, we are focusing efforts on our 2 nearby locations in Raleigh for now and hope to be back to serve pizza-loving Tar Heels soon." Topper's roughly 1,500 square feet of commercial real estate will become available for lease at the beginning of September. Topper's still has 2 franchise locations in North Raleigh, off Creedmoor Road and Ronald Drive. America's top burger joint, located in Chapel Hill. If you're looking for the best burger in the country, you won't have to travel far. Chapel Hill's Al's Burger Shack has been named the top burger restaurant in America by travel site TripAdvisor. The award was based on millions of reviews and opinions from TripAdvisor diners. Opened in 2013, Al's Burger Shack prides itself on being a local restaurant serving all-natural burgers. Some of the signature items on its menu include the Bobo Chili Cheeseburger, the Paco, Kenny J, and the newly added Marcus Page. TripAdvisor's praise is just one of Al's many accolades. The restaurant has also been awarded the number one burger in Chapel Hill by Yelp. Indie Week readers named it 2014's best new restaurant for Orange Chatham Counties. And StraightBeef.com, an award-winning burger blog, named Al's to its list of top five burgers of all time. The TripAdvisor Award took into account the ratio and quality of great burger reviews in comparison to overall reviews, along with quantity and quality of reviews received in the past year. Featured restaurants were required to have at least 200 reviews and 10 locations or less. Al's Burger Shack currently has 4.5 out of 5 bubbles on TripAdvisor and has two Chapel Hill locations at 516 West Franklin Street and 708 Market Street. And now we turn to the Viewpoint page. We'll read a column written by John Hood, who is chairman of the John Locke Foundation. The headline, Time to Push Back on These Federal Budget Deficits. Right after the 2016 elections, I observed that the combination of Donald Trump's rise and continuing GOP strength across the landscape of American politics had yielded three distinct Republican parties: a populist and personality-driven White House party, a more traditionally conservative but often ineffective Capitol Hill party, and a grassroots party of results-oriented governors, legislators, and other politicians and policymakers who have amassed an impressive record of conservative reform at the state and local levels, including right here in North Carolina. I think this remains a useful model for interpreting the political and policy developments of the past 2 years. There is one big exception to my model: federal spending. Unfortunately, all three Republican factions appear to agree that the issue isn't particularly important. Tax reform was enacted without significant budget savings to offset the fiscal impact. Neither Congress nor the administration has proposed a serious budget to bring expenditures in line with projected revenues. Irresponsibly, President Trump has said that reforming entitlements, which constitute most of federal spending, is off the table. Also irresponsibly, congressional Republicans haven't really argued the point. For their part, Republican governors and legislators have irresponsibly chosen not to push Washington on fiscal restraint, but instead to seek and spend more borrowed federal money on Medicaid, education, roads, and other programs. This is all foolishness. It is bad governance and even worse politics. Remember the Tea Party rallies of 2009 and 2010? Protesters were outraged about annual federal deficits approaching and then exceeding $1 trillion a year. They properly blamed presidents and lawmakers of both parties. Recently, the Trump administration released its mid-year budget adjustments. The federal deficit is now expected to reach $890 billion, or 4.4% of gross domestic product, by the end of the 2018 fiscal year. Next year, the deficit will rise to $1.085 trillion, or 5.1% of GDP, and then stay above the trillion-dollar mark for at least two more years. Recent spending increases and tax cuts help to explain the short-term trend, but the truth is that Washington's finances would be in shambles without them. Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, and other entitlements were growing faster than the revenue needed to finance them even before the tax cuts. State policymakers should resist the urge to treat Washington as a cash machine. It has no money to spit out unless it first taxes us or borrows against future tax hikes. Rather than playing along with fiscal delusions, state leaders should pledge to support some kind of structural constraint on federal deficits, such as a balanced budget amendment, and in the meantime learn to say no to offers of free federal money, which includes, yes, the idea of expanding Medicaid in its current form. It's time the grassroots party picked a fight. And now we turn to the small business section to read Edward Marshall's column. Edward Marshall is an adjunct professor in management at the Fuqua School of Business at Duke University. The headline, Companies Must Now Focus on Respect at Work. Moral authority comes from following universal and timeless principles like honesty, integrity, treating people with respect. Stephen Covey. We're living in a time when the basic rights of people are being disrespected, not the least of whom are the babies and children being torn from the arms of their immigrant mothers. Many are asking, is this who we are as a people? Is this how we should treat other human beings? Respect is a fundamental principle of human conduct, and right now, in many spheres, it is being violated. Permission has been given to behave in unethical ways. As a result, we are losing our moral authority. What is happening nationally has created the context for how people may be treated at work. In the last few years, we have seen a dramatic increase in the violation of basic ethics and morality, creating workplaces that are not fit for the human spirit. A major bank opening accounts without customer permission, a high-tech company secretly accessing private data, pharmaceutical companies charging excessive prices for life-saving drugs, and the sexual harassment of women in the workplace. Have we lost our way? Have we lost our basic respect for the dignity of each and every human being, whether they are a citizen, a customer, or in our workforce? When there is talk of civility, there also needs to be a fundamental conversation about morality and decency, about how we honor the rights and dignity of every human being. We have a lot of work to do to get us to a place where we can look at ourselves in the mirror and say we are proud of who we are and what we stand for. Saying no. We start by saying no to disrespectful behavior and no to hateful conduct. Stand up. We must take a stand both at work and in our communities for the respectful treatment of every human being, regardless of religion, gender, race, or sexual orientation. Affirm. We must affirm the principles of honor, integrity, and value for every human being. Engage. Then we can engage others in dialogue and actions that empower others to affirm these principles. Our vision is to not only create workplaces fit for the human spirit, but also to create a society that is grounded in a moral authority that is based on respect for the dignity and humanity of every person. There is much more work to be done. Each one of us can start this journey right now by saying no to hate and yes to respect. Now we turn to the executive voice, focusing on David Morkin, age 49, family, wife, Chriselle, 6 children, education, BA, political science and government, Oral Roberts University, JD, University of Notre Dame, first startup, online tax filing service, efiling.com in 1994. The headline, Bandwidth's Morkin is expecting more growth, and this is written by Lauren Onasorge. Quietly, at NC State University's Centennial Campus, Bandwidth has grown into a public powerhouse. The company, which recently spun out wireless carrier Republic Wireless, went public last year, filing for an $85 million IPO. Today, it has more than 340 employees, expanding at that same footprint and hiring. CEO David Morkin says Bandwidth is in the triangle for the long haul. We have had opportunities to move the whole company, and we haven't, he says. We think the future is bright, and the vast majority of our hiring is right here. Morkin calls Bandwidth a 19-year-old overnight success. As a public company, it has resources it never had before. The challenge? Putting the capital to work. It's exciting, he says. My optimism comes from seeing the energy, the enthusiasm, the opportunity. As part of the spending plan, the company is hiring, particularly developers. Morkin says 2018 is a year of learning and discovery for the company, and that includes its global strategy. As Bandwidth considers its international presence, it's evaluating how customers spend their money. International growth will follow suit, he says. The company will follow the international demands of its customers rather than just building overseas and acquiring new ones, he says. In the meantime, Morkin is enjoying life as a public company CEO. The biggest surprise is the benefits, he says. They are significant. Particularly, Morkin is talking about the expanded visibility of being a public company. Big companies know who Bandwidth is now, he says. That's translating into growth. The company recently crossed the 1,000 total enterprise customer milestone, a 26% year-over-year growth in active communications platform as a service customers. The larger brands have more confidence in us and are approaching us to work with us more than they have in the past, Morkin explains. We attribute it very directly to the transparency of being a public company. When you're private, a CFO might ask to share the balance sheet. When you're public, they know my blood type, he jokes. You're approached by larger companies that have more confidence in you. His advice for companies seeking an IPO? You have to have a world-class finance and legal team, Morkin says. If you have the right kind of strength that we have in those areas, then the public markets are a good, broad path to take. He says it's a way of rewarding your own team with stock options and experience. For his C-level executives, it's the first time serving in such a high role at a public company. From my perspective as a schmuck capitalist founder dude, I love that, he says. I think the reason we were able to do it is the quality of the people on the team. Morkin admits it's a rare lineup, but for us, it's right, he says. Other than Carmichael Partners, Bandwidth has avoided institutional capital. That meant time to consider all options, not just an exit, when its team found that, to take advantage of the opportunity, we had to grow faster than our own cash flow. Now that it's on the other side, a big focus is being placed on hiring. The majority of the band, as he calls them, comes from North Carolina universities. Being in the old Red Hat space at Centennial Campus has been critical in building that team, Morkin says, noting that the university ecosystem has provided a quality of life for his employees that couldn't be matched at other locations. For Bandwidth, employee retention and recruitment comes down to culture, he says. I'll put our culture up against Amazon's culture, he explains. Frame posters recount some of the team's past exploits. The Great Tuna Run, for example, a 200-mile relay race that begins in Raleigh and ends at the coast. And shuttle buses cart employees from the headquarters to an NC State gym for a midday workout. But will Morkin be able to maintain it as a public company? Yes, he says, pointing to mission statements on the walls. We live it, Morkin says. And finally, we'll read just the beginning of a Lauren Onosorge article headlined, Finding Talent, a Key Challenge for North Carolina's Rural Counties. The biggest problem in rural economic development? The talent pool, said Nathan Ramsey, director of Asheville-based Mountain Area Workforce Development Board, speaking to a group that included more than 60 economic developers from across the state. He told the crowd gathered for the Economic Development Partnership of North Carolina's Energizing Rural North Carolina event July 12th that instead of just focusing on the skills gap, they need to fight what he sees as a more immediate threat, the interest gap. He goes on to mention how they need to build more interest in training programs. We've run out of time for today's episode of the Triangle Business Journal. Be sure to listen at the same time next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Derek Frost, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, triangleReadingService.org. So long until next time, and if you have any comments or questions, please give us a call at 919-832-5138. Thank you.